think you've done a great job at putting a panel together. Really, was irresistible to everyone, and I've interacted with generally everybody on this panel. I've actually been using Coase and Holland's genetic algorithms, which really do work. We have evolution in the machine, and what we evolve are neural nets, and the neural nets actually learn. In this case, we're feeding them all the stock market data, and if they do a good job, they get to survive in the next generation and procreate sexually. That's their reward for making money. And and this is how the algorithm works. And they we put this through thousands of generations, and the surviving investors, when they're not procreating, are actually making money in the stock market. So, I'd like to I'll comment on a couple of things that that Doug said. The reason that progress in the 21st century is so surprising to people. We'll see if we can psych out that technology here. It's because of the exponential nature of paradigm shift. I like to contrast what I call the intuitive linear view with the historical exponential view. When people think about the future, when they think about 50 years or 100 years from now, they think of 50 or 100 years of progress at the current rate, even if, like all the members of this panel, we've been around long enough to see that paradigm shift is not occurring at a constant rate. In fact, I've plotted this. And you can argue about any of the data points on there, whether how long did it take for the web to be adopted and so on. But if you look at a very broad exponential view, tens of thousands of years ago, it took us tens of thousands of years to figure out that sharpening both sides of a stone created a sharp edge and a useful tool. 1,000 years ago, a paradigm shift only took a few hundred years. In the 19th century, we had paradigm shifts in only a few decades. We now have paradigm shifts in just a few years. It seems hardly a week goes by where I don't hear about some new internet business model. But right now, paradigm shifts are really doubling every 10 years, which means the next 10 years will really be like 20 years. And that paradigm shift rate is very constant. I mean, you can go back to the beginning of technology. In fact, you can go back to the beginning of biological evolution. The first paradigm shifts took billions of years for the first cells to form, and in the Cambrian explosion, paradigm shifts only took a few tens of millions of years. And in fact, you see, if you put this on an appropriate exponential graph, the evolution of technology just continues at exponential, rapidly increasing pace of paradigm shift from biological evolution. Human-created technology is really the cutting edge of evolution on this planet. If we go out sufficiently into the 21st century and follow this progression of the acceleration of paradigm shift, we see that the 21st century is actually about 20,000 years long. We'll make 20,000 years of progress in the 21st century at current rates of progress. And that's why the future is startling. That's why we tend to underestimate what's feasible in the long term. We overestimate what's feasible in the very short term because we tend to leave things out of our plans. But this exponential growth of technology and of the pace of technology is what makes the future surprising. Now, look, I want to start talking about feasibility. I want to leave some time to talk about Bill Joy's concerns. If we have time at the end, I'll talk about consciousness, but that'll probably take 5 minutes, so we may not have time for that. We'll have entities that seem conscious, whether they really are or not. Actually, I think there's no objective way of telling. It's a whole difference between objective and the concepts of objective and subjective. So there I've discussed consciousness. And when we consider feasibility of machines that rival at least human intelligence and that will seem conscious, one of the reasons that machines don't seem very conscious, that they don't seem emotional, that they don't get the joke, is because they're still a million times simpler than the human brain. The human brain is an entity that has hundreds of billions, trillions of parts. We haven't really encountered machines of that complexity. When we do these machines, for reasons that I will talk about, we'll begin to exhibit the kinds of subtle, rich, deep processes that we associate with human intelligence. But let's talk first about just hardware feasibility. And it's not my position that if we have sufficiently fast computers and a sufficient amount of memory that we automatically get human-level intelligence. You might be able to compute your spreadsheet in 2 nanoseconds, but that's not necessarily going to give you the subtlety of human intelligence. But for reasons that I'll talk about, I think the software does not lag the hardware by very much. But if we first consider hardware, Doug showed a progression of Moore's Law. Now, this and one key issue, a very important issue in the 21st century, is how long is that trend going to go on? I was on a panel at Agenda 2000 with some of the Intel leaders, and they estimated that Moore's Law will run out of steam in 12 to 18 years. Moore's Law states that we're shrinking the size of transistors. They're not quite this big, but every 24 months we can shrink them by 50%, so you can put twice as much stuff on an integrated circuit, and it runs twice as fast because the electrons don't have that far to go. That's actually a quadrupling of the price performance of computing right now every 2 years. And that's going to run out of steam in 12 to 18 years because by that time the key features will only be a few atoms in width. We won't be able to shrink them anymore. What happens then? Is that the end of the exponential growth of computing? And if you think it is, then you have a very different outlook for the 21st century than otherwise. The first thing that I did, and Hans Moravec has done some similar studies, is put computing and calculating devices on an exponential graph. Going back substantially before Moore's Law, because we didn't have integrated circuits until 1957, we didn't have transistors until 48. And I put 49 famous computers, starting with the electromechanical calculators used in the 1890 census, the first automated census, Turing's machine, which cracked the Nazi Enigma code, the computer in 1956 that CBS used to predict the election of Eisenhower, up until the PC you bought your nephew for Christmas last winter, and put these 49 machines on an exponential graph. And first of all, it showed that the exponential growth of computing goes back at least 100 years. And it goes back through five different paradigms. Moore's Law is not the first paradigm. It's the fifth paradigm to provide exponential growth of computing. We had electromechanical calculators, relay-based computers, vacuum tubes, discrete transistors, and now integrated circuits. And what we see, and the key issue for the 21st century, is the sigmoid or S-curve versus exponential growth. We see the S-curve, which is things start out exponential and then level off in lots of phenomena. Rabbits in Australia, they grow exponentially, but then they exhaust their resources. And in fact, any of these specific paradigms, and Moore's Law is one of them, does reach an asymptote and eventually runs out of steam. But what we see is that paradigm shift, a change in paradigm, occurs right as that leveling off occurs. And there's usually multiple paradigms competing, and they exist before the old paradigm runs out of steam, but the new paradigm has enough momentum to stay in the lead. But as it levels off, these competitive technologies then take off. They were shrinking vacuum tubes, but then they finally couldn't shrink them anymore and maintain the vacuums required, and transistors came along right at the appropriate time. And a transistor is not a small vacuum tube. It's a completely different paradigm. So this suggests that paradigm shift keeps the exponential growth going. I've since done similar studies, and I was going to show some graphs, but 25 minutes it would take too long, so I'll just describe them. But you see similar exponential growth for lots of technological processes. Brain scanning, genome scanning. When the genome project was started 12 years ago, the skeptics said, there's no way you're going to finish this project. At the rates at which we can sequence DNA, it's going to take 10,000 years to finish the project. But in fact, if you look at it, it's an exponential growth. We've been speeding up the speed with which we can sequence a genome, so we're going to finish actually somewhat early. Miniaturization is another exponential trend. We're shrinking technology right now at a rate of 5.6 per linear dimension per decade, and that's been going on for a very long time. Telecommunications is even more dramatic than computing. Brain scanning speeds, I mentioned. There's a wide variety of phenomena that follow this exponential growth. And the other interesting thing I noticed on this chart is that it's actually double exponential growth. On this logarithmic chart going back to 1900, a full century of exponential growth of computing, it's on a logarithmic graph is actually an exponential. and Hans and I have been trading formulas to try to find some sort of mathematically sensible derivation of this double exponential, and Hans' formulas are actually more aggressive than mine, so I'm actually the conservative in that particular dialogue. His actually ends up going even faster than double exponential growth. But as Doug showed, exponential growth alone is quite sufficient. But I think it's important to not only look at this in terms of a theoretical approach of what speed paradigm shifts occur and the fact that paradigm shift has, in all of these processes, kept exponential growth going in these technological processes. We need to identify the actual technologies that are likely to be the sixth paradigm now in terms of continuing exponential growth of computing. It's quite clear that the sixth paradigm will be the third dimension. We live in a three-dimensional world. Our brain is organized in three dimensions. Why not use the third dimension? Chips are flat. And there are already, as in times past, competing technologies that are already working in limited degree in laboratories. In fact, since both Hans and my book came out, there's been significant developments. There was one announced just last week by IBM in molecular computing and building circuits in three dimensions. My favorite is nanotubes, which are these hexagonal arrays of carbon atoms that are very strong. They can do computing without heat. Superconducting. By manipulating the structures, you can create three-dimensional structures that do computing. I figured out that a one-inch cube of nanotube circuitry would be about a million times more powerful than the human brain. So, I mean, we can touch and feel already the technology, the sixth paradigm, that will keep this going well beyond any of the scenarios we're likely to talk about today. And by 2019, according to my calculations, $1,000 of circuitry will equal the 20 million billion calculations per second that the human brain is capable of. And those calculations vary depending on whose estimate. There are a few orders of magnitude difference. The estimate I'm using is, I think, towards the conservative side. By 2029, $1,000 of computation will equal 1,000 human brains. By 2050, $1,000 of computation will be 10 to the 26th power calculations per second, which is the amount of computation that takes place in all human brains on Earth today, all biological brains. And that 10 to the 26th power is flat. I mean, that's not growing. That hasn't grown for a long time. I mean, it's growing at the rate of population growth, but that's extremely slow. It's basically flat compared to non-biological computation, which is growing at this double exponential rate. Okay, that provides the requisite computing power, but that doesn't automatically give you human-level intelligence. The software of intelligence, I think, is even more important. And there are many different approaches to this. I talk a lot about reverse engineering the human brain and deriving the templates of intelligence from understanding the human brain. And I do that not because I feel that's necessarily the only or even the predominant strategy that we will use. I think we will continue basic artificial intelligence research. We will use biologically inspired models that are not exact copies of biological systems, such as genetic algorithms, neural nets, and there are a whole variety of other biologically inspired algorithms. As we learn more about the human brain, we have more powerful biologically inspired models. For example, Carver Mead's work at Caltech were based on actual scans of the early visual processing of the brain, and also he has a similar project in the auditory processing. These are digitally controlled analog chips that perform very much the same functions that we see in these biological neural networks in mammals. And his chips are used in high-end digital cameras. So we will use biologically inspired models, but I think the easiest scenario to understand is the reverse engineering of the human brain. I mean, we have 500 or 600 examples in this room, and it's not hidden from us. And human brain scanning is another one of these exponential trends. You can see the speed, resolution, bandwidth of brain scanning is increasing, actually at a double exponential rate. That's what my own charts show, and partly that's due because it's driven by computational increases. If you consider the following scenario, By 2029, this will be a conservative scenario. We can almost build devices like this today, but not small enough. But if we send billions of nanobots through the bloodstream, they would travel in very close physical proximity to all of the key neural features in the brain. We have scanning technology already. There's one very impressive scanning technology from the Weizmann Institute in Israel, where if the scanning tip is right near the neural features, it can see the neural features non-invasively with extremely high resolution. So we could scan my brain today by just moving the scanning tip very close proximity to all the neural features in my brain. If we want to wait to be able to do this without making a mess of things, we'd want to send the scanners through the bloodstream. There's a whole issue as to what resolution you want to scan the human brain. If we look at a number of experiments that have been done at emulating neural functioning, then neural interconnections, neurotransmitter concentrations, synaptic collapse are sufficient to reverse engineer and understand the basic information processing of the regions that we have already reverse engineered. Now, there's arguments. Some people say, no, you've got to look at every single dimple on every single axon and dendrite and get the exact shape. And if, in fact, you increase the resolution with which you have to understand the human brain by a factor of a billion, that still only sets you back by about 27 years because of the exponential growth of these systems. And I think we need to distinguish between downloading the human brain as one scenario, which has been particularly controversial, and just understanding basic human intellectual processes, which we have actually done with certain regions of the brain that we have access to. We use in our speech recognition software the results of understanding of the early auditory cortex, and when that information came available, it dramatically increased the accuracy of our speech recognition software. We don't have access to the bulk of the human brain, but when we can scan it from inside, what we find are that there are very repetitive features, repetitive patterns in the organization of each of the regions of the brain. The brain is not really one information processing organ. It's hundreds of different regions. Each of those information processing organs is organized completely differently, but there's a great deal of repetitiveness in those regions. They're dynamic systems. As we understand the nature of dynamic systems from things like genetic algorithms and neural nets, we can build systems that are inspired by our understanding of the reverse engineering of the human brain. I think the most powerful way that we will build software, the way that the kind of work that I've done, which is pattern recognition, has built software, is by self-organizing systems, not traditional artificial intelligence or expert systems where we program rules or where we do combinatorial explosions like Deep Blue. But really, the strength of human intelligence is that massive parallelism we have, which allows us to do very deep pattern recognition. My own work with neural nets is we build the neural nets going beyond traditional neural nets of just three simple models. When we create very complex nets with many different layers and complex interconnection schemes and lots of neurons, they become harder to train. Providing education of those neural nets becomes more complex, more challenging, but we get much more intelligent behavior. When we can build neural nets that are at a human scale, when we can see how the human brain is organized from these very high resolution scans, we will understand these human processes in far greater detail, and we will have systems that allow us to basically emulate those algorithms, create entities that have human-level complexity and richness. And I think we will see a great diversity of entities. It doesn't mean we're necessarily going to just create non-biological versions of humans.
If we send the nanobots through the bloodstream, there are technologies today where an electronic device can actually detect the firing of a nearby neuron and can actually cause the neuron to fire and suppress it from firing. So there's already means of doing non-invasive two-way communication between the neural world and the electronic world. These neurons could travel through the brain, and because they'll all be on a wireless local area network, which is technology that Bill is pioneering, we'll be able to expand human intelligence, creating new neural networks. We'll be able to create virtual reality from within. The nanobots pick up positions by all the nerve fibers coming from all of the senses. They can turn off the senses from our real senses, provide the signals that we would be receiving if we were in the virtual environment, and therefore provide full immersion virtual reality involving all of the senses. I think that'll be a feasible scenario by 2029. And so meetings like this one, we could all meet in virtual reality. We'll, in fact, as virtual reality becomes more compelling and more realistic and more detailed, our encounters from business negotiations to central encounters will take place in virtual environments. I think we will expand both human experience. These nanobots, since they are inside the brain, can also stimulate the neurological correlates of emotion. I talk about in my book this one girl, when a particular spot in her brain was triggered, she started to laugh. They thought they had just triggered some involuntary laugh response. But actually, they had triggered the perception of humor. She just found everything hilarious whenever they triggered this one spot. "You guys are just so funny standing there," she would say. Well, I really only have time to touch on these subjects. Let me say something about Bill Joy's discussion in Wired magazine, the whole issue of the positive and negative aspects of technology. Technology has always been a double-edged sword. You don't have to look further than today's technology to see that. I think key point I would make is that it's not feasible to select the positive from the negative sides of technology. Now, Bill said he started having these nightmares when he met me in a bar at the George Gilder conference. That's why I don't hang out in bars very much. But I think the basic, I think it's a challenge. There are grave downsides to these technologies. Certainly, that's already taken place in the 20th century. The story of the 21st century hasn't been written yet. I think the only way to forego technology in general would be to have a totalitarian system that basically would use technology to enforce no one else having technology. I don't think it's feasible to stop technology in specific areas that are going to be dangerous. I mean, I'm going to work on these safe technologies of more intelligent software and faster computers, but not this dangerous technology of nanotechnology. That doesn't mean that we have to ignore these downsides, but I was going to read you another quote from Bill, from Kaczynski, but Ted Kaczynski, but I don't really have time for that. But he makes the point that you can't have much progress in, say, medicine, which he acknowledges as a positive, without the whole technological system and everything that goes with it. And of course, he comes to the conclusion that the bad parts of technology outweigh the good parts, that the danger is so salient that we should not go down the technological route. But in my mind, it's inevitable because technology development is decentralized. We're moving towards the kinds of scenarios that Bill talks about, and he'll articulate in far more detail, through some centralized project, but through thousands, tens of thousands of interacting projects, each of which are working on some benign, further advanced, based on some competitive economic force that they're or industry that they're contending with. The net result of many different generations of technology through all of these interacting means of understanding the human brain, developing smaller and smaller technology, more and more powerful computers, better biological models of intelligence, is to develop some systems that would seem to have some downsides. But in my mind, that's true today. If you describe today to people hundreds of years ago, they would find it very frightening. They would say, well, why take the risk of the kinds of downsides that, for example, a biotechnology means exist today in a routine bioengineering laboratory to create bioengineered pathogens that would be extremely destructive. But very few people today would want to go back to the short, brutish, poverty-filled, disease-filled, short, tenuous lives that 99% of the human race suffered with. So I think we have no choice but to find sophisticated,
ways to manage the dangers, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that as we go.